This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. If you wonder why animals do some of the amazing things they do, give us a call right now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. And among the calls this hour, we'll also explore another special topic.
This week, we're going to talk about a mystery guest that lives in many of our backyards across the country. But you know, most of us don't really know it because it only comes out at night.
Well, who is it?
I'm not telling.
You're not telling.
You're going to have to wait and see.
All right, I'll wait. We'll also welcome an award-winning scientist to the show to talk about the emotional lives of animals. We'll find out more about the emotions animals do experience and why they matter. And that's all to come this hour. But first, let's take some calls. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our first caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Jane. I'm calling from Madison.
Madison, Wisconsin. Jane, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I've got a puzzling one. I have two beagles and a cat. And beagle number one I've had since she was about 8 weeks old. She came home and the cat was there.
Okay.
The cat was immediately in charge and they became fast friends and all was well. And then about 10 months ago, I rescued a male beagle who is at the time was about one, we guessed to be about a little over one.
Okay.
So he's a little different. He's a little bigger. He's probably realistically more of a bagel. He's got some basset in him, definitely.
I love the bagel description.
Yeah. He's and he has definitely that big bark. He's kind of lumpy and big and just, but he's the most lovable creature in the world.
Aww.
I mean, I've never seen him have any sort of aggression towards a person or another dog. He's
great,
very social.
Great.
However,
you know there's a bug coming, right?
The minute he entered the house, the cat jumped to the countertop where she pretty much exists all the time up on the cabinets while the dogs are home, and he sits absolutely obsessed staring at her. And you know, at first we're like, oh, it's so cute, he adores her, and but I really, we're 10 months into this thing now, and my question is really this stare that can sometimes just go on for hours. It's like, you know, we want to think, please, he's saying, please come down and play with me, but my question is he also saying, please come down so I can eat you?
Probably.
Or chase you around.
Yeah, and I don't know whether to really try to push this relationship, get, you know, have her come down. Is there anything, which way do I go? Do I try to force this relationship or just let them develop it, hopefully, eventually?
It's a really good question, and I should preface my answer by saying that my answer is not just theoretical. It's also very personal because I have a year-old border collie who, at this very moment, I am working on not obsessing over the cat. And for those of you who haven't experienced it, having an animal stare with that intense stare at another individual animal in your house, for some reason, Larry, it's exhausting. Isn't it, Jane? Don't you find that it's just tiring?
It is. And then I end up staring, too. So it's a really interesting house.
So first of all, I would let your cat do whatever your cat wants to do. I would let your cat stay up on the counter. Don't force that by any means. I would start working, as am I, on teaching your dog a different response to whenever he sees the cat.
Okay.
So what I would suggest for him, does he love toys?
Oh, yes. And that's the other scary part. He always has something hanging out of his mouth that looks like the cat.
But that's actually, we can use that to our advantage.
Okay.
Because what I want you to do is, every time he looks at the cat, and this is a bit tiresome also, but in the long run will be less so. Every time he looks at the cat, I want you to say, where's your toy?
Okay.
And then then you're going to help him find it. You pick it up. You wave it in front of his face 180 degrees away from the cat.
Okay.
And you do that over and over and over again. Give him lots of reinforcement. And the idea is that eventually, automatically, without you saying anything, you may do it 6 times in a row, for example. And the 7th time, he's going to be like, well, she's going to say, where's your toy?
Okay.
And then, if I go get my toy, she plays tug of war or something with me with it. So I'm not going to wait for that, where's your toy cue? I'm just going to go play with my toy myself. When he does, I want you to just make a big fuss over him, play extra fun, maybe give him treats. You can use treats for this too.
Okay.
Basically, it's what I call a jackpot.
All right. Okay.
And so it's a little tiresome, and I actually, some of the time, I actually put my cat she has a suite now, a little kitty suite. And so when I need a break, I will just put the cat in the kitty suite, shut the door, and then I don't have to sort of be on all the time.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And, you know, Teddy in Florida called our show after hearing about a caller who, like Jane here, was having trouble introducing cats to dogs. And Teddy says he had a Siamese ragdoll cat and two dogs, a minpin and a beagle. And, of course, the beagle always wanted to play, but the cat wanted nothing to do with it. To fix this problem, Teddy put up a child gate across one area of the house. And then to hurry the process along, he would pet the cat and then pet the dog. Then he would pet the dog and then pet the cat, hoping to get them familiar with each other's scents. Teddy says it took a couple of months, but eventually the cat decided to go ahead and get friendly with the dog. And in fact, she even tries to wake him up, wax him on his ears, and wants to play.
That's very cute. And I think that was all great advice for particular circumstances where you have a cat who's a little afraid of the dog and you have a little minpin who are basically smaller than cats. But I'm not, you know, when you get that obsessive staring from a dog to a cat, and we do know beagles were bred, as were bassets, to be small animal hunters. So just like my stalking border collie, and, you know, I'm just a little worried about the way he would play with my cat. So I think in this situation, I think you're better off teaching a different response to Kitty.
Okay. Jane, thanks a lot for calling. And by the way, if someone wants to send us a pet tip, how do they do that?
We'd love to hear from you. Send us your ideas. They're most welcome to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to join us, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. Let's take a question from our email box, Patricia. And here's one from a listener who writes the following. I live in the central Idaho mountains and enjoy running with my dog on the old logging roads in the wooded mountains behind my house. My dog has treed a black bear twice on our runs.
Eeps!
Yeah, both encounters ended well. I really didn't know the best course of action to take when it happened. And the first time it happened, I left the dog at the base of the tree and continued on my way. The dog eventually caught up to me, but I'm fairly sure he was chased, which could bring the bear to me. The second time my dog treed a black bear, I backed off toward home, and as I did, the bear started to come back down the tree. My dog chased it up another tree before my husband answered my call from a cell phone and joined me in the woods. We were then able to safely get the dog on a leash, take some photos, and retreat. I'm more concerned for the dog's safety than my own, as I feel it's more likely the bear would go after my dog. On the other hand, there is also the concern of the dog bringing the bear to me. I now carry both a leash and a cell phone, but refrain from packing heat. I'd like to continue to run with my dog unleashed in these beautiful woods, but I expect more bear encounters. I just thought I'd ask what you think is the best course of action in these situations.
Boy, I would advise some serious action, short of packing heat here.
She names herself sincerely running with bears in Idaho.
As opposed to running with wolves. I love it. You are in great danger, let me just say, right now. You are, yes, these are black bears, but not grizzly bears. But black bears can kill people, and they certainly can kill dogs. It's not an uncommon problem at all, actually, in northern Wisconsin, where they're black bears, but not grizzlies. So first of all, you're not going to want to hear this. But if it was me, I have to tell you, I wouldn't be running my dog off leash in those woods. I just wouldn't. I think that you're putting yourself and your dog at tremendous risk. I think that especially if this is the same bear, as time goes on, the bear's starting to learn. The dog's becoming more familiar. So I think the chance is every encounter has an increased chance of serious aggression, if not mortality. So and both you and your dog are at extreme risk. So I would not let my dog run off leash. And I love to let dogs run off leash safely. But I would put your dog on a long line. In this circumstance, even with your dog on a line, I would not go out, given these encounters you've had, without bear spray. And you can buy bear spray. It's a kind of a pepper spray, but you need to be really careful about the percentage of active ingredient in it. There are, if you get sort of the usual pepper spray, you can buy it in a hardware store. It ain't going to have any effect on a bear. But you can go online. You can order it. When my partner Jim and I were hiking in Yellowstone, we stopped at the store and we got our little can of bear spray. And I talked to the ranger. I said, would you go out without bear spray? And he said, no.
Are you kidding?
No. So we never had to use it, but it changed the feeling we had just tremendously. So I would use a leash and I would use bear spray. And I hate to take your dog's freedom away, but you hate to take your children's freedom away also, but you wouldn't let them play in traffic. So I think given what's happened, I would be an ounce of prevention here is worth a dramatic story.
Err on the side of caution.
Yeah.
And if somebody wants to email us a question, how do they do that?
Well, we love to hear your questions, particularly interesting ones like this. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And again, you can call us at 1-800-462-7413. Matter of fact, somebody has done just that, so let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Casey from Madison, Wisconsin.
Hi, Casey. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, we actually spoke once previously. I have a rat terrier that's about a year and a half old who's having some problems with submission and urination.
Okay.
Your suggestion was to get her to the vet as quick as I could, which I actually hung up and called my vet and got her in the same day.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Good girl.
2 days worth of testing. They can't find anything wrong with her. Everything medically looks fine with her. And my vet actually suggested that it was probably a behavioral problem and I should look into that avenue, which preempted my call back. So the problem that she's having is the submission and the urination, and it only happens at certain times of the day. It happens first thing in the morning where she won't come downstairs with me to go outside. I have to physically pick her shaking little body up and carry her down and put her outside to get her to go out.
You know what I try doing? I don't know what's going on. Obviously, there's some fear-related problem. And you might, if we can't find another solution, you might want to talk to your veterinarian about some kind of just very temporary anti-anxiety medication. Because it sounds like some kind of a phobia. But what I would suggest doing just practically is, since this sort of bending over and picking up is so problematic, I almost wonder if it hurts her when you pick her up or something. But here's what I would do. I would leave a long line attached to her. Cut off the loop. So don't put a regular leash on, because the loop can get caught on something, and I don't want her to get caught sleeping at night. Let her sleep on her little bed. And then in the morning, hopefully that line, you can pick up the end of the line without having to pick her up. And then you pick up the end of the line, and you go, come on, darling, let's go. You don't even look at her, and you just go trotting away.
So let her sleep with a leash on, is what you're saying?
Yeah, with a leash with no loop. So there's less chance that she's going to get caught on something and get hurt. Have you tried, here's another question, have you tried just tossing food in front of her?
Yeah, if I do a treat, like when I come home at lunch and if I open up her crate door, she won't come out. Even if I have a treat, she won't come out. But if I have a toy and a treat, she'll come out.
Well, that's something you might try in the morning, too, is, again, avoid the reaching towards and the bending over. That's what elicits that submissive urination. So I would basically experiment with, how can I get her out without going over and at her?
Yeah, and she's not in anything at night. She's just simply on a bed.
Yeah, but you said you had to pick her up. So I want you to try and try to find a way to get her out without actually picking her up. So try toys, try treats, and try this leash.
Thanks a lot for calling, Casey, and good luck. Let us know how things turn out.
Okay? Call us back again and keep us posted.
1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, we'll reveal the identity of the backyard animal you probably didn't even know you had. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week, Patricia's going to introduce us to a guest we probably didn't even know we had in our backyard.
That's right. You know, in 3/4 of the country, just about anybody who has a yard with trees has this adorable animal in their yard that they probably have never even seen.
And the mystery animal is, ta-da!
The flying squirrel, ta-da! Actually, it sounds like the flying circus act or something. They are like circus acts. They're amazing animals. And, you know, they're really common. They're everywhere except in the Southwest. But they're nocturnal. And so we just don't see them very much. But they're just amazing animals. They're very small. They're much smaller than our regular gray tree squirrels. During the day, we don't see them because they're sleeping in these little cavities. They live in little nest holes. And they come out at night, and they eat everything. They're omnivores. They eat insects. Mm-hmm. Yay. They eat acorns. They eat slugs. Yay.
Yay. It's no wonder we've never seen them.
Yeah, because they only come out at night.
Well, how do flying squirrels actually fly?
Well, good question. And, of course, as we all know, they don't actually really fly, right? Mm-hmm. But they glide. And they can glide a long way. And they do that by using a membrane that stretches between their front and their back legs. It's called the patagium. For some reason, I love that word, the patagium.
Hmm.
And the patagium, it's a lot like the membrane between your thumb and your forefinger.
Yep.
You know, but
I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, we all have one, but it's a lot more of it. You know, it's quite extensive, and it's covered in this very short, very dense little fur that's very good at avoiding wind resistance, and it has muscles in it that they can loosen or tighten this membrane to actually regulate their flight path.
Very cool. How far can they glide?
Get ready. Are you sitting down? They can glide a football field. They can glide
100 yards.
Now, obviously, they don't do that very often. Most of them are much shorter, but they have what's called the glide ratio is 3-1, which means if they can go up to 100 feet vertically, they can glide 100 yards horizontally.
Wow. How can we find out if we have flying squirrels living in our yard?
Well, that's, since we're not nocturnal, that's the problem, right? Well, there's one thing you can do is to get night vision binoculars. They're not that hard to get anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, you know, we've had guests on the show before who talked about how many animals there are outside once it gets dark. So that's one possibility is watch around your bird feeders. They love the same kind of things that are birds like. They like seeds. They like suet. They love peanut butter. And so that's something you can do is they often raid your bird feeders at night. You can also try, if you're really into it, you can set feeders on the ground and then put sand around and then look for their tracks. That's actually a very interesting way. It's a great project if you have children. Get a book on tracks and then put sand around and see if you can find some flying squirrel tracks. They have extremely elongated feet, very sharp nails, which obviously they use to sort of grab onto tree trunks. So there are all kinds of fun ways you could make this into a kind of a fun backyard science project.
And, you know, I have many friends. I haven't purchased one myself yet, but I'm going to. A motion camera for taking pictures at night, which you can set up.
Oh.
And they're not expensive. The cost has come way down.
I was going to say.
Cost has come way down over the last 4 or 5 years. And so they're within reach now of my poor budget.
That'd be great. That'd be great. So they're the kind that have a kind of a laser light beam sensor, and when an animal crosses it, then a flash goes off and it takes a picture of the animal. Oh, what a great idea.
Yeah, so that's another way to do it. If you'd like to learn more about flying squirrels, we have more information, and we have some links, too, on our website, callingallpets.org. So look them up. And give us a call if you have a question, 1-800-462-7413. Here's another caller. Hello, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hey, I'm Matt from Oklahoma City.
Matt, thanks a lot for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I adopted Logan. He's a Pomeranian mix, about 17 pounds, from a Second Chance Animal Shelter in Oklahoma. And about a year ago, and we think he originally came from a pretty good family, but the family that was going to adopt him before me had a bunch of kids, and we think they threw water balloons at him.
Ooh.
And so as a result, he was returned to the shelter. And then I adopted him about a week later.
Okay.
Well, when I got him, he was so skittish around anyone besides me, perfectly normal around me. But if anyone else came in, he'd run under the bed, would not come out until they were gone.
Aww.
And now a year later, he's a little bit better. But if he gets around two or three people that he doesn't know, he's back underneath the bed.
Okay.
So I was wondering, is there anything that I can do to get him more comfortable around people?
Yes, there absolutely is. And just parenthetically, you're describing a dog who probably didn't grow up with a family. Or if it was a family, it was a family that didn't have a lot of visitors.
Uh-huh.
You're describing a dog who's social developmental period was probably highly limited. So I'm so glad you got Logan.
Yeah, he's an extremely well-behaved dog. I mean, he came and he was trained, and he's just an amazing, amazing dog.
Well, good boy. Well, good boy.
Was well taken care of
before. Yeah, okay. So he just might have been socially isolated, but very loved by the one person who had him. So here's some things you can do, and it's basically a kind of classical conditioning. It's called counter-classical conditioning because you want to counter one emotion with a better one, better mm-hmm. being happy rather mm-hmm. than fearful. And so what you're going to do is figure out what Logan really, really loves. I'm going to call that the treat, but it doesn't always have to be food. It could be toys, but it's the thing that he just worked the hardest for. It's like, oh, if only I could live rolling in, you know, chicken or tennis balls or something, whatever he really adores. And you're going to restrict access to that. He's only going to get that when there are unfamiliar people around. And they're going to provide it. But they're not going to provide it by making him come up to them and take it out of their hand or something. They're basically going to pretend he's not there. They're going to play, quote, hard to get. They're not even going to turn to face him. They're not going to walk towards him. They're not going to try and pet him. They're going to stay well away from him, turned a little bit to the side. But they're going to toss food in his direction or tennis balls or whatever it is he loves over and over and over again. Then they're going to leave. So basically, they come in the house. You sort of set up. I've had counter conditioning parties for clients, and I had a dog I actually ended up taking and rehabilitating for 3 months. And once we could get people safely in the door without getting bitten, which took a while, then they would come to the door. I would open the door. They would stand there. They would toss treats, and then they would leave. And we'd have like 6 people in a row do that. And then I'd put the dog in another room, and then I'd let them in and reinforce them by giving them a party. You know, I'd make them pizza or, you know, make them some special dessert or something. So they'd come back again and help me again and do it the next weekend. So that's the game, is that basically you're gonna teach your dog that the trigger being the unfamiliar people, is actually a cue that the treat that he really loves is going to come. And the trick is to have the unfamiliar people be at a very low intensity, meaning they're not close to him, they don't walk towards him, they don't try and pet him. And then gradually over time, they can get a little closer. They can walk 2 steps towards him and then toss a treat and then walk away and then do that 5 times in a row. And then just sit down, and then if he wants to run in the other room, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. But so, just keep it up.
Yeah, does that all make sense?
It does. Yeah, he's been getting better, but it's just I would like to see him be more comfortable around people, and that sounds like an excellent
this
way.
This might
to
jump
do
start it a yeah, little yeah. bit, yeah.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Matt. 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello, this is Lucy from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Hi, Lucy. Thank you for calling.
Okay. I retired recently after 40 years of school and work and no dogs. I had been a cat person, but luckily I think I adopted the idiot-proof dog. I have a few questions, though. They're mostly general development questions. She really is a very good dog. She house-trained quickly, and she's just a nice dog. But she likes to carry her leash in her mouth.
Mm-hmm.
We work a lot on loose leash walking. I haven't even started heel yet because she's just 7 months old. And I'm working with her on not making me a sled dog or not
right.
making me a sled.
Right.
What should I be doing about the leash biting, if anything? And on exercise, I think she goes to doggy daycare 2 days a week, and I try to get her out to the off-leash dog park 3 days for a good two turns around, and then when we don't do either of those, we walk at least 3 miles. But that's not running. When we
right.
walk, we walk.
First of all, about the leash, absolutely, even though it can be endearing, I don't want her grabbing the leash, because basically what that means is that as she gets older and as she gets bigger and as she gets more motivated to do things on her own, particularly in these sort of adolescent phase that she's just moving into, then you're going to start running into bigger problems. And the solution is easy. Spray it with something called bitter apple. It's made from apple seeds. It's very bitter. And most dogs don't like it. Now, every once in a while, a dog didn't read that particular label, you know, on the can, mm-hmm. but most dogs don't like it. But every time you go out, you're going to have to reapply it, or at least once a day for a while, just get her out of the habit.
When she was a little puppy, she ignored bitter apple, but you think it might work now?
It might. It might. And there's another product. Oh, I can't think of its name right now. But it's made out of quinine, which is also very bitter. And I have had a couple of dogs who thought bitter apple was just nummy, tasty mm-hmm. stuff, who didn't like this quinine product. I just can't think of the name of it right now. But you can find it.
You can
it.
Find that.
Yeah, you can find that. So that's one possibility. In terms of exercise, let me just deal with that one because it's so important for a dog of her age. She will tell you, basically, whether she's getting enough exercise or not. If she's constantly trying to initiate play, if she's never settling down, if she's sort of bouncing off the walls, then she's probably not getting enough exercise. Do keep in mind that dogs, especially of this kind of breeding, need mental exercise as well as they need physical exercise. And that can actually tire them out and settle them down as well as physical exercise. So this is a great time to start teaching her to heel. It's very stimulating. It's very interesting. Dogs have to concentrate. There are other dogs there, and they have to pay attention and be polite and listen and learn new things. So that's another form of exercise. So combine the physical and the mental exercise. So you are now in the midst of dog raising. And so that's a dog raising manual as summarized as I can make it.
And Lucy, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Here's the number for you to call, 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, we'll welcome a guest to help us survey the emotional lives of animals. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week, we welcome Mark Beckoff to the program. Mark is Professor Emeritus of Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder and is the author of the book, The Emotional Lives of Animals. A leading scientist explores animal joy, sorrow, and empathy and why they matter. And he joins us today to talk about it. Mark, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
What are the emotions that you say animals share with humans?
Well, I see joy and pleasure and happiness, grief, despair, likely embarrassment, jealousy, resentment, the whole panoply of emotions that we see in humans.
Those are pretty complex emotions that you're talking about. Something like embarrassment, for example.
Yeah, I think they are. I think I spend a lot more time talking about maybe the simpler emotions. I actually think joy and happiness, fear, of course, are relatively simple emotions, as grief and sadness. So I'd agree that sometimes the stories and the data that are collected on emotions such as jealousy, resentment, embarrassment may be equivocal, but I think the data and the observations we have of joy, grief, fear, or not.
Describe some of the ways that animals communicate their feelings.
Well, they communicate in a number of ways. Visual signals, of course, postures, gestures, gaits, facial expressions, body movements, tail, tail position, ear, you know, position, and just a general demeanor. They also communicate using an incredible complex set of vocalizations, as well as odors. And I think one of the things that I try to bring out in my writing and my lectures is, because I'm a biologist, the question that motivates my research is, what is it like to be a particular animal? And then get into that animal's sensory and motor world, if you will, how they express themselves using motor systems and muscles, and the sorts of information that they are able to process. So it's a very complex thing, but, you know, after 35 years of studying dogs and wild relatives like wolves and coyotes, I feel that I have a pretty good idea of the relationship between what's going on inside their heads and their hearts and the behaviors that they express.
Mark, given the similarities between the expressions, for example, of humans and non-human animals when they appear to be expressing joy or happiness or fear, why do you think some people are so resistant to attributing those kind of emotions to non-human animals?
That's a great question. I think one of the things that's happening is that the number of skeptics is really, really declining. 10 years ago, they were a dime a dozen lining up at the door. And these days, for example, I just wrote an article for New Scientist magazine, and they wanted a skeptic, and it was very difficult to find when they finally found one. But I think that there's resistance because of hardcore biology, that there are differences in kind rather than differences in degree among, say, the mammals. But I think some of the resistance is philosophically motivated. You know, people go, well, the minds of other animals, including humans, of course, are private, secret, or hidden. But in my book and elsewhere, I've talked about what I call the public lives of animals. I think people just haven't spent the time studying the animals. It's amazing to me how many people feel free to write about animal behavior who have never studied animals, no less lived with them. You've got philosophers sitting in ivory towers telling you what animals are supposed to be doing. And I don't mean that in a pejorative or negative way, but, you know, I don't sit down and write about law because I'm not a lawyer. The other source of resistance is just because a lot of people have a very difficult, complicated, or ambiguous relationship with animals. They've got dogs at home with whom they live. They name them. They don't hesitate to tell you how smart or emotional their dog is. And then they go into laboratories and they do incredibly invasive experiments on dogs. So I think there's that schizophrenia out there that drives people to distance themselves. But like we said before, the data that are coming in ethology, cognitive ethology, the study of animal minds, and social neuroscience are presenting such a compelling case that, frankly, it's very difficult to find a hardcore skeptic today, even among the scientists.
You talk about elephants, and why do you say elephants are the poster species for animal emotions?
Well, they're getting so much press. I mean, number one, 6 zoos in America have decided they're going to phase out their elephant exhibits because they can't meet the social, behavioral, or emotional and physical needs of the elephants. At least 4 elephants have died in zoos in the last year or two in America. And I think that elephants are the poster child because we know they're highly social. They live in very, very strongly social groups in which there's a matriarch. We know they have infinite memories. We know that they grieve the loss of dead friends and non-friends, it's turning out. And I think they're just attracting a lot of attention. Cover story in New York Times Magazine in fall of 2006, Are We Driving Elephants Crazy? A Time Magazine article last June, Should We Be Keeping Elephants in Zoos? And in fact, next week I'll be doing an interview along these lines. I think people have latched onto these animals because they are amazing beasts. I've been with them in the wild in Africa, and I can tell you right now that all you do is need to be 5 seconds in a group of elephants, and you can feel their feelings.
Mark, you cite research, but you also include several examples in your book just of people who have observed various emotions in animals, including yourself. And you talked in one case about a fox. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's a number of stories. One deals with a fox who was killed by a mountain lion by my house. The night before, I had almost opened up my car door to the mountain lion, thinking that he was my neighbor's dog, thinking the dog shouldn't be out here. And the next day I went out, and there was a fox carcass, male, and there was a female burying the carcass. She was scratching pine needles and dirt over it. She'd stop, she'd look, she'd reorient herself in a very, very defined ritual. Now, was she mourning the loss of her mate? Well, I think so. Was she burying the mate with some kind of respect? I don't know, but then a few years ago, I watched magpies do the same thing. I came across a dead magpie who had been hit by a car. One magpie went in, pecked the carcass. Another did. One flew off, brought grass back, laid it by the corpse. Another did, and then they flew off. And after I published that story, I got countless emails from people who had seen the same kind of a ceremony, if you will, in other magpies, ravens, and crows. So once again, you know, if we blend the stories with the data and we take the time to look at the details, we're going to come up with some really, really convincing evidence for animal emotions.
You know, Mark, both you and I have been trained as ethologists, and in that training we were trained to be very cautious about being anthropomorphic. It was sort of a dirty word, right, in science.
Mm-hmm.
What is your take on the dangers, but also on the value of being anthropomorphic?
Well, I don't think there's any danger if you do it carefully. So I always put forth that we need to be what I call biocentrically anthropomorphic, taking into account the view of the animal. It's doing what comes naturally. I've studied the evolution of anthropomorphism and its use. And there's no other way to access the minds and the hearts of other animals, but we just need to be careful. And once again, I've got to say, the last 2 years I've been to 5 continents and many, many countries. I've given popular lectures and hardcore scientific lectures, and I got to tell you that this is not arguable anymore. It used to be, but now people just say, okay, you know, if we want to access the animals, we need to use language with which we're familiar, and that's being anthropomorphic. Of course, the other side of the coin is if we accept that animals have strong emotional lives, we're not inserting anything into them by being anthropomorphic. We're just using anthropomorphism as an explanatory tool. We're not making up something that's not there. So all in all, I'd have to say, in the last 3 months, I've been to 7 countries. I just got back from Tasmania. I've been with hardcore scientists, and unless they're just trying to be nice to me, nobody's really coming to... I mean, really, no one is having an issue with anthropomorphism. What we are doing, though, is we're learning, as Patricia knows, that there is no substitute for the detailed study of animals. That's why I spend my life looking frame by frame in films, because if we're going to marry the social neuroscience data with ethology, we need the details.
What kind of research do you think we need to be doing before we can understand whatever it is we need to understand about the emotional lives of animals?
We need to return to basics. We need to do the details, and we need to bring it together with this non-invasive social neuroscience. I'm going to a meeting in 2 weeks at Oxford that's run by the Medical Research Council and the Cold Spring Harbor Labs. I'm so excited about it because half of the meeting is going to be hardcore neuroscience. The other is going to be ethology and animal behavior. And when they invited me, you know, just jokingly, I said to them, you know what you're going to get. And they said, yeah, we know what we're going to get. We need the background in ethology. So I see the future for graduate students and for the future for research as bringing together finally, in a really motivated way, ethology and neuroscience. And I hope I live another 50 years, although I don't think I will, because I would like to see the fruits of that labor. But I'm really serious. It's just astounding what we're learning. There's trust centers, they call them, in the human brain, altruism centers, and there's no doubt we'll find analogs of that in human brains when we do the proper research.
Mark, thank you very much for being with us. Mark Beckoff is the author of The Emotional Lives of Animals, A Leading Scientist Explores Animal Joy, Sorrow, and Empathy, and Why They Matter. He joined us today from the studios of KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. Stay tuned. Our animal trivia question of the week is next, with your chance to win a copy of Mark's book. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. Now, if you think you know the answer to this week's question, you should give us a call. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. All correct guessers will have their names pulled together, and two winners will be selected at random to win a copy of The Emotional Lives of Animals by Mark Beckoff. And here's today's question. In his book, Mark points out that humpback whales, fin whales, killer whales, and sperm whales all possess the same special type of brain cell as humans do. These brain cells are found in the area of the brain that's linked with empathy, intuition about the feelings of others, as well as rapid gut reactions. They were once thought to be unique to humans and other great apes, but it turns out that whales not only have these special cells, they have more of them than humans do. What are these special brain cells called? If you think you know the answer and the name of these special brain cells, call us. Here's the number again, 1-800-462-7413. And then to find out the correct answer, check our website in about a week. We'll have it posted online at callingallpets.org. And if you have a question for us right now, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. Once again, and here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Sherry at Wetoma, Wisconsin.
Hi, Sherry. Thank you for calling.
I just got two new kittens, and I was wondering how I have one older cat, and I need some help or ideas to get the older cat and the kittens together, because the older cat doesn't seem too happy about the situation.
Mm. Yeah.
Are they separated now?
I do have a safe room for the older cat, which is my bedroom, and a large bathroom that has, the litter pan and the food and everything mm-hmm. in there, too. I only separate them when I'm not here for long periods of time, and I separate them at night.
So a couple questions for you before I can give you some advice. How long have the kittens been there? How long has this introduction been going on?
Now almost 2 weeks.
Okay, so it's pretty new, based in a cat's perspective anyway. Cats can be very, very slow to accept newcomers. They're just very slow about it. So is there any aggression going on? Does the older cat attack the kittens? What's going on?
First of all, she ignores them.
Okay.
But when they come up to her or try to bat her tail or uh-huh. something like that, she will bat at them and give them a kiss.
Okay. But she has ready, easy access to a safe place.
She does.
She can stay away from them, and luckily there are two of them, so they tend to play with each other a lot, right?
Right.
Well, given that, you might just want to keep things the way they are and just let time take its course. If we could go backwards, I would have suggested that you actually kept them separate in sort of logistically so that they actually had no physical contact but could get used to each other's smell, which is always the best way to introduce new cats. Let them get used to each other's smell first. They can be sniff noses under the door, but better, they can't even do that. Better one cat's in one room, one cat's in another room, and then one at a time, the newcomer and the resident can come out, pat around the shared area, get used to each other's smell. So that's ideal, but, that's ideal,
Ideal, that's right.
That was then.
I wish I had known this 2 weeks ago.
That's okay. That's all right. There's a famous dog training saying, I know this is dogs, not cats, but it still relates, which is we train by regret. So every professional trainer has a long list of I wish I had not or I wish I knew then. So don't worry. You're a member of a very large club. But it sounds as though if the cat is just batting a little bit and hissing and there's no growling anymore, that's good, and it's only been 2 weeks, you really might be fine just letting things go the way they're going. Don't try to force anything. Always be sure that your older cat has every possibility of escaping. What you might want to do, though, the one thing I think I would change, is have a period of time where your older cat has run of the house where the kittens aren't out. So part of the time, put the kittens in another room.
Oh, okay.
Because, your resident used to have run of the house, so now all of a sudden, that's been taken away. The kittens are new. They don't know what's normal.
That's true.
Yeah. So take, you know, have a period of time where a couple hours every evening maybe where the kittens get put in another room and they get used to that. And your older cat gets the freedom to wander around.
Oh, okay. That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's only 2 weeks, which is not very long. And it could be months before things get to
normal.
6 months
is the average.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Patricia, we heard from Karis and Jeff, who have this email question about their black and white cat named Marshall, and here's what they write. Marshall, who looks just like a dead skunk if he lays belly up, is about 8 years old. We saved him several years ago from an abandoned home, and boy, was he happy about that. We've moved 3 times in the 2 to 3 years since we've had him, and each time he's adjusted perfectly. He doesn't appear to be stressed at all. However, within the last year, his black hair on his back and shoulders are turning totally gray. He's now black and white and gray. I know dogs turn gray around the face, but Marshall's face is still black. Could this be caused by stress or old age? We can't find any information on this subject anywhere, and we hope you can help.
Well, that's a really interesting one. It's not something you commonly hear about, and it's true that cats don't tend to as notably age in terms of their hair going gray like humans and dogs do. That's another link between humans and dogs, right? But it's not uncommon for the color of cat's hair to change a bit. And basically, if the cat was black and now it's turning, or some of the fur was black and now it's turning gray, it's lost a certain amount of melanin, which is what causes that black color.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible that it's age-related. It's I suppose it's possible that it was related to some kind of a skin disorder or injury. I mean, you'll often see the coat color change if there's been a wound, for example, mm-hmm. and then when the hair goes back, it often will grow back a different color. But it doesn't sound like there was anything that explained that. As long as the cat is really healthy, I wouldn't worry about it at all.
Yeah.
I would just appreciate your cat's tricolor glory.
And how do people email us?
Oh, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
Or you can give us a call. Here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Victor from Wonder Lake, Illinois.
Victor, hi. Thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
In a previous show, you had you made a comment about dogs being lonely. And I wonder if the same thing is true of cats. My son and I get into an argument every time we go on vacation. He has his own family. He's got 3 cats. And then we have 3 cats. You know, my wife and I are both retired. And whenever we leave, we always feel like we've got to have somebody come in and you know, just look on them and
mm-hmm.
feed them. But my son says, no. Cats have no sense of time. They don't know, you know, they live in the present. You know, like eternity. So they don't get lonely. So he says, you know, he puts out a bucket of water and a you know a ton of cat food, and he thinks that's fine. And
boy,
we don't.
It's a really, really good question, and there are two issues here. One is, do cats get lonely or not? And the other is, do cats have a sense of time? And
right.
And the latter one, you know, I'm really interested in this issue, and I'll just briefly say that it's something that has been said for eons, that animals have no sense of time.
Mm-hmm.
I have never seen any data, ever, ever,
yeah,
ever, that I mean, we don't know. Are they more in the present than we are? Oh, yeah, we're pretty sure about that. Mm-hmm. Does that mean they have no sense of time? I don't really know that that's true. So,
well, see, it's the only thing about that to me is they seem to remember. Of course, that could be conditioning. You know, like they know who you are, and they know, you know, you're the feeder. And
yeah, but that is different than having sort of knowing you've been gone
memory,
for.
I mean, yeah,
well,
it's that memory. Yeah.
Having knowing you were gone for 2 weeks rather than you were gone for a day or something.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah.
But let me address the question about being lonely, because we do know a little bit more about that. We know that many mammals have social bonds that have the same physiological and neurological basis as our social bonds, and they involve the same hormones. Oxytocin is the one that's sort of most famous. And there are all kinds of physiological changes when you separate animals who are bonded together. So is it possible for an animal to be lonely in some ways? Not exactly, but in some way similar to the way we are? Oh, absolutely, if we're talking about a social mammal. Absolutely. Now, are three cats lonely when you leave? Well, it's hard to know. Do they miss you? If they're very bonded to you, they very well might. Are they suffering terribly? Possibly not, since they have each other. And if they're bonded together, that certainly would help things. But I do want to say one thing that relates to an issue that hasn't been brought up that I think is the most critical here, which is safety and health.
Yeah, that was running through my mind as well.
Was it?
2 weeks is a long time.
Oh, things happen. You know, there's a reason. There's a reason that saying that I can't repeat on the radio is so famous as stuff happens. It does. And, you know, you can get an animal caught in something. You can have an animal who becomes ill. So I would never, ever leave animals alone that long. I would at minimum have somebody come in once or twice a day. Might they be fine? Sure. You know, they might be. They probably will be. But if the risk is death and a really painful, long, horrible one, then who's going to take that risk, even if there's only a 1 or 2% chance of it?
And frankly, you know, 2-week-old water, I wouldn't want to drink it.
Oh, yeah. And cats are very fussy about the water they drink.
Yeah. So you win, Victor. tell your son that he has got to get somebody in there to watch those, look after his cats.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you
very
much.
Daddy knows best.
Daddy does know best in this case. You mentioned whether or not animals have a sense of time. I have a sense of time, and I've noticed that time is running out for us.
Funny you should bring that up now, Dr. Mueller.
Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to bring you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. And Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0503P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website once again is callingallpets.org.